Good morning. Good morning, everybody. I'm calling to order this specially called meeting of the Board of Regents for April 24th, and I will ask Regent Dennison to call the roll, please.
Regent Mayo.
Present.
Regent Brodie.
Present.
Regent Hammonds.
Present.
Regent Helm.
Here.
Regent Milliken.
Here.
Regent Nichols.
She's there. She's there.
Oh, did you say Nichols?
I'm here.
I'm sorry, I'm here.
Regent Spiller.
Present.
Vice Chair Thomas.
Present.
Chair West.
Present.
And Regent Kurtz.
Might be a bit out of date there. Rush is here.
Whoops.
So we have 11 regents present representing quorum.
All right. Good morning, everybody. And good to see the regents on Zoom as well. For our agenda today, we have one action item for the executive committee, and that is the approval of authorization for P3 student housing transaction. President Caboni.
Chair West, thank you so much for the opportunity to share with you an update on the work we've been doing around housing at WKU, and which we have termed Elevate WKU, the totality of the project. We've made great progress in the past 6 months and are at a place now where we would like to share with you a development agreement with our partners, a whole set of partners, but the prime one being with Gill Bank. You will recall in the fall we had a pre-development agreement approved, and this is, say we've been dating for 6 months or so, and today we think is the marriage, so to say. So we have a cast of not hundreds, but it feels like dozens, and actually may have been close to 100 folks working on this for the past 6 months. Many of the principals are here in the room with us or on Zoom. I will remind folks that we were working in three separate buckets, a group of folks who are working on the development side, a group of folks who were working on the construction and design side, and then a group of folks who were in finance, and the group of folks who have been advising us. I'll walk through some of the advisors for us first, and then we can go on to kind of a project update from our good friends at Gill Bank. But if the folks running the show will put up slide number 2, that would be wonderful. There we go. So you see the developer team there, names that should be familiar to all of you, Gilbane being the lead, the design build team. But for our purposes today, we have been working closely for well over a year now with our advisors. You'll see Brasser and Dunleavy, Julian Sagastume is on the call, and they've been working with us since last November to think about not just how we navigated through some of the challenges we face, but also how do we use this really as an opportunity for a reset and a transformation of all of our housing on campus. Baird and the Student Life Foundation also worked with B&D, and so they know us and they know us well. As does Mark Rawlings, who's here with us in person as our financial advisor with Baird. He also has a long history with the Student Life Foundation and knows our housing situation and our finances very, very well. Barnes Thornburg, our national P3 attorneys and consultants, are represented by Steve Park, who's worked with us to ensure that the deal and the structure that we put together serves the institution well. And last but certainly not least, Dinsmore, who's represented here today by Mark Franklin, has worked with us locally to ensure we're meeting all of the state standards for public-private partnerships and also to ensure that whatever it is we enter into is not just comprehensive, but also protects and serves the institution well. You have in front of you a resolution, and this resolution will tie together the almost 500 pages of other documents that we provided electronically to you and to the public. I will say I'm very proud of the work that we've done over the past 6 months. This deal is probably the largest deal the university has ever done in its history. And it is complicated, and it also is elegantly built and will serve us well for the term of the partnership. I want to pause here because I'd like for you to get an update from Gil Bain around what the work that we've done to date, and then we will re-engage with the document. So we have Jeffrey Rosetko, who is the day-to-day lead on the developer side, and then Jeff Eisenrocker, who's also on the call, and they're going to share with you kind of what we've done since November. So Jeff and Jeff, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, President Gaboni, and thank you for, it's good to see many of you virtually since I was there last, I guess it was 2 months ago now, to give you the last update. And we are proud to say that we are on track with all of our milestone dates, and I'll get into that in a moment. But let me just give you a status update very quickly at high level. So the project remains a wonderful new residential community of just over 1,000 new bedrooms for students, a mix of single and double occupied rooms. And the project is 6 stories, remains a brick exterior with a wonderful collegiate architecture that you've seen, and that remains unchanged. The dining facility has improved quite a bit. It's adjacent to the Great Hall, which many of you remember, to act as a 24-hour study facility for anyone on campus. So I think it's going to be a great hub for those looking for the ability to study and interact with their peers on campus. We'll have some dining and a grab and go that will be accessible for many hours of the day to really complement that great hall, as well as to support the 1,000 students living in the new building. So again, those images that you probably remember in your mind, you may have a packet in front of you, they all remain very well intact, and we've continued to refine those. We have completed a set of 100% design development drawings, which essentially enable us to go out to subcontractors and obtain pricing for the project, which we have been very actively doing. The construction team reports that there's strong interest from the subcontractor community, and we're excited to firm up and confirm our budget over the next 3 weeks, and in advance of the closing and sale of bonds, we will have a confirmed price, and we are on track to be within the budget that we currently have set up for the project. So so that's great. We've sort of considered that all systems go, and we, as President Gaboni said, with the mayor's group ready to say I do as soon as those numbers come in, and we expect them to do so. From a schedule perspective, I mentioned the design development drawings completed. Our next milestones really begin with the completion of the estimating and the establishment of the final price, which we will then used towards our final closing. We will be doing some work in advance of the final closing, starting on May 11th, and that will be mostly logistics, putting up fencing, getting the construction team trailers, and basically logistical items ready so that we can begin our abatement. The halls that are in the way of the new building, Douglas Keene and Hugh Poland have some abatement that needs to be done. The final abatement study will be confirmed as soon as students move out on May 11th, and then we will submit our notices to the state, and we will begin abatement approximately June 8th. As soon as abatement is complete, we will start the demolition. We have both of those halls as well as the den scheduled for demolition, and that will begin in earnest as part of the demolition and abatement process. In addition to that, we will be renovating the rooms and the common areas of Southwest Hall. That will begin as well on May 11th. And we don't have any abatement there, but we do have quite a bit of work to remove the existing finishes. We will be installing new flooring, new paint, new countertops, new bathroom fixtures, new lighting, and really refreshing the student rooms to make them feel modern, similar to the room refreshments that have taken place over the past few years. In addition to that, we will be putting new carpeting and new paint in the corridors, and we will be updating the common areas with new counters, new furniture, as well as new finishes. So it will be a sparkling new Southwest Hall come August of this summer for the return of students, and it will be the first of our milestones for this exciting partnership. I think that covers everything from a scope and a schedule perspective. President Gimone or others, did I miss anything that you would like me to tackle?
No, I'll pause there and see if the regents have any schedule or work questions before we dive into the resolution and what is to come. Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Jeff. Very excited about to be where we are. Great update. And exciting to see the progress that we've made. I'm proud of the partnership that we have been building together for the past many months. And it's been just a terrific working relationship. And we're beginning to see the real outcomes and the fruit of that. Not just in the real world with construction beginning, but also with the framework of a structure that will serve the university and our partners well for the lifetime of this partnership. And so with that, I will pivot to the resolution that you have in front of you, which essentially brings together the totality of the structure that we're putting in place to accomplish a transformation of housing at WKU. To really elevate our community and change the way in which we're perceived and our housing options are perceived at the institution. I want to pause there for a second and thank the Student Life Foundation, which has been a terrific partner for the university and has worked hard to serve us for over 20 years. And there are many leaders who have invested countless hours of their time, effort, and energy, I think they deserve our great thanks. It may have been a rocky few months with some of the structures we're having to work through, but there's no doubt in anyone's mind that those individuals care deeply about WKU, were committed to doing things in the best interest of the institution, and so I want to take this opportunity to publicly thank their board for their partnership for 20 years, but also their partnership in getting us to today. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we go through both the documents and your questions. But they have continued to be good partners for the institution, as they have been for over 20 years. With that, I hope you all read the resolution before you read the other 500 pages. I did not. And I think this is very artfully done. There is one decision point for the board today. It is the request to approve the resolution, which essentially enables the rest of the pages to go into effect during the next 6 weeks. To guide us through that, our local council, Mark Franklin, another bow tie guy, for which I am very excited. There are three of us in the room today. We'll work through the resolution and answer any questions you might have. And slide two, very good. Mark, thank you for being here. And Thank you for your partnership, too.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm happy to discuss the resolution. As President Kamani said, it is designed to encompass and approve the entire P3 procurement process. So it does take a very large overview of the entire process for you to consider. So in the recitals, what we want to do for the resolution is capture the fact that this is the completion of a P3 procurement. It's a particular kind of procurement under state law. And that began some months ago when the university obviously released a request for qualifications, and then has now led to the selection of Gilbane as your private public partner. And so the resolution, first and foremost, is the completion of that process. The president referenced it as the marriage takes place today. That's where the resolution is headed, but we want to cover and address all the different specific requirements of state law and procurement law as we work through that, and also authorize all the related actions. So we address that in the recitals. We kind of always like to explain why we're here, so we reference the reasons of the normal in Regents led to this Hilltopper issue, and then also a desire of the university just to think proactively and towards the future about its housing, student housing, and a desire to push that forward in the future in a very positive and forward-thinking way. And so as we move into the resolution, we have a definitional section which is really there to hopefully improve the readability of the operative portions of the resolution once we get to those. And so in section 3, we take the steps of, it's pretty typical, just reaffirming all the actions taken by the university's agents and officials over these past few months in working through the selection process and developing the agreements that are described in the resolution, and saying and affirming those processes and discussions that have occurred. In section 4, in order to award the procurement is actually under state law for a project. That is what state law requires. So we want to define what that project is so that the board can identify what it's actually approving. The actions related to SLF are described later in the resolution, but where we begin in terms of the project is the SLF has transferred all the existing student housing facilities fee title specifically back to the university. So the university has once again become owner of those properties. The first step that is a portion of the project is that the university is going to give a ground lease interest in the land underneath all of its student housing facilities to a company called Collegiate Housing Foundation, or a subsidiary of that entity. And this chart that's on the screen is a very helpful way to look at all the different entities that are involved in this P3 procurement. There, as you can see, it's not just the University and Gilbane. Gilbane is your primary partner, but another key player in the procurement is Collegiate Housing Foundation. It's an independent 501c3 organization that serves not only WKU but other universities around the country, and its purpose is to allow. Primarily to allow for tax-exempt financing for improvements. So, as you know, the university issues tax-exempt debt when it finances its own improvements around the campus. Gilbane is obviously, as your developer, is a for-profit company. So if we only utilize Gilbane in the process of the procurement, tax-exempt financing would be difficult. So in this structure and similar structures around the country, they've come to utilize independent 501c3, much like SLF. I think as Mark Rawlings says, SLF was a P3 designed before P3 was cool, so to speak, so that we can keep tax-exempt financing as in this transaction and in potential future transactions for the benefit of the university. And so Collegiate Housing Foundation, in order to take advantage of that, actually needs to be the owner and user of the facilities itself so tax-exempt financing can be available. So the first step is providing CHF, not actually Gilbane, the ground lease interest in the land underneath the university's housing facilities. And then the second step is giving them fee title ownership of the actual facilities themselves. So that will make CHF the owner of the new housing facilities. CHF will then have the responsibility under the ground lease you see described from the university to own, operate, maintain, and manage those facilities. That's where Gilbane then comes in as your private partner. CHF essentially contracts away all those responsibilities to Gilbane and its related affiliates. So another key entity you see is Inwood, which is described on the top kind of right side of the screen. That's the management company Gilbane has to provide the management services that are necessary with respect to the housing system. So there will be a management agreement. So the next big step is, though, CHF is going to take the steps necessary to retain Gilbane, to construct the new dormitory, which we heard about, and dining facility in place of the other two dorms and dining facility that are being demolished. And so that is the next. So you'll have a new 1,000-bed, approximately 1,000-bed dorm and dining facility. And we also heard about step four. There will be improvements made to the other remaining housing facilities around campus. Jeff did a great description of that. Those improvements are expected to be. And then last, once SLF will transfer ownership of Normal and Regent to the university, it will retain responsibility to complete those renovations under an arrangement with SLF. And once those renovations are completed, fee title will then be transferred by the university to Collegiate Housing Foundation for those two dorms to be added back into the housing system to be operated by Inwood on behalf of Gilbane and CHF. Now, all of the cost of all this, both paying off SLF's current debt, financing the new dorm, financing the new improvements, and carrying out all the other costs related to this process will be financed with a new series of tax exempt debt to be undertaken by Collegiate Housing Foundation. That's also described in Section 4 of the resolution. That amount's expected, obviously, to be under $400 million and have a term of approximately 40 years. Now, it's clear to say, want to make sure and say that the university is not financially liable for the debt to be incurred by CHF. CHF's debt will be secured solely by the revenues of the housing system itself, not by the university's financial obligations. So much like the SLF structure that's been in place over the last 25 years. But one point of a difference, and Mark Rawlings may speak about this later, is that under this structure, the university will actually receive back surplus revenues of the housing system. So that is an area of differentiation. So excess revenues are generated, we do expect that there will be excess revenues. Those will come back to the university under this P3 structure. So Section 5 of the resolution, under state law, this board is required to make certain determinations when making a P3 procurement. Those are set out in the regulation. We simply mirror those in the resolution to ensure that we've complied with the requirements of state law with respect to this procurement. In Section 6, we actually have the marriage, so to speak, the marriage vows of it, the board, and its affiliated companies, and other partners to complete the procurement. And in Section 7, we authorize the university to execute and participate in any legal documentation necessary to effectuate the procurement. We break the relevant documents out into project documents, things like the management agreement, and then the financing documents, things like a CHF's trust indenture and lease or loan agreement. Now, it's important to note, although there are, as you can see, there are a lot of documents on the screen, a lot of parties, the university itself is a party to very few documents, actually, once the P3 is effectuated. And the primary document, although not the only document from the university, is really the ground lease. That's really the key document from the university's perspective. Much of the other documents, for example, the bond purchase agreement, the trust indenture, the management agreement, the university is not actually a party to. But in the course of the award, we want to essentially bless the entire structure from the university's perspective. And then in Section 8, which is really the last key operative portion of the resolution, we address the SLF situation and authorize essentially the return of ownership of all of the housing assets from SLF back to the university and address any actions that are necessary related to that, such as execution of deeds and bills of sale and items of that nature. So fundamentally, that is the relative and operative content of the resolution. I'm happy to address any questions anybody has related to it. Yes?
Just so I understand. It's similar to the SLF situation in that the university is not liable for the debt. It's different in that we get money back, whereas with SLF, we really didn't.
Correct. That's right.
I would add to that. outside of the document, one of the things that we were searching for were national expertise and partners with national expertise, and Gilbain and Collegiate Housing and Inwood bring that to the table. Again, one of the challenges that I think we encountered was not using national housing experts and not having third-party objective oversight, and we've rectified that with this agreement. Really important to note.
And will there be third-party oversight of the repairs to normal?
Yes, the documents require a construction monitor that's independent of SLF and its agents to monitor the repairs. That's important from Gilbain and CHS perspective also, because when they take Regents and Normal to operate them, they want to ensure that they're under standards.
Do we have a representative from Inwood working with us yet, or is that going to be later on since they're going to be the managers? There's somebody there.
Jeff or Jeffrey, do you want to address that? If not, we can.
I'm happy to address it. I couldn't exactly hear the question, but happy to.
Great. It was, have we been working yet with Inwood? And I mean, the short answer is yes, but I'd look to you to describe that.
Yes. So as part of our working group that spans design, construction, development, we have had working groups with Inwood on a separate track that include Dr. Laroche, her whole housing team, and leadership from Inwood. And so we have been meeting regularly to coordinate hiring, training, staffing, emergency response protocols, aligning on turnover day roles and responsibilities for the ultimate goal of making sure that on the date of switchover and integration that everyone knows what they are doing, what the condition of housing is pre and post that date, to make sure, above all else, that guests and students on the campus as soon as June, because you will have students living on campus and guests in the forms of camps and conferences, ideally they have no clue what is going on and it is just another day on campus where they are just receiving phenomenal service from folks that are providing it to them, and that we have been planning on utilizing the remainder of the summer to make sure that we prepare and make those units ready for welcoming the students back in the fall. But it has been on the agenda from day one, so this last 6 months of planning has not just been about the project, it's been absolutely about the operational component of this as well.
And what director will start on campus on or around May 4th?
May 4th. So Student Life Foundation will really not be doing, they won't be looking at those dorms, or this will all be Inwood that will be managing them starting May 4th.
The maintenance operation beginning June 1.
Beginning June 1.
That's the official takeover date.
But the conversation has been that Student Life Foundation will not, and Sodexo will not be responsible for summer turnover, meaning we have to get those rooms ready for summer camps. And so we're going to work with Inwood to get those rooms ready for this summer. So the partnership actually starts a little bit before the partnership actually begins. We're going to have a separate contractual arrangement to get that done.
Where did you say that Regents and Normal would be transferred to until the renovations were complete?
Yeah, so fee title will return to the university under an agreement being entered into between the university and SLF. SLF will retain the responsibility to complete the renovations, even though a fee title will be held by the university.
What's fee title mean? Forgive me.
Ownership. Sorry, fancy lawyer's speak.
Still an undergrad, sorry.
Trying to be accurate.
So, not to jump ahead on things you might ask part of the presentation, but just walking through the transition, we'll see there's a lot of interest on campus about the buildings that we have. The transition of those buildings, Hilltopper Hall, Regents Normal, for example, we said that demolition would start June 8th. We want to figure out what the abatement is. Will, for Keenan Poland, will that be down by the end of summer? Is that, that's the cleared off? What's the...
The goal is to have them down and us able to break, essentially break ground in August, September.
Okay.
Again, these things evolve as they go.
Right.
And so I don't want to go on record saying a specific date, but the goal is to essentially have demolition complete, and we're beginning to do site grading and other work. And Jeffrey, I'll turn to you for your expertise on how this likely will progress.
Yes, so the progression, we will be working through the summer on the abatement and demolition, and then the site work utilities will also be started. So the utilities that will be adjusted this summer include chilled water from the university plant as well as steam. Those will be adjusted, and again, those are university-controlled utilities. This fall, we will be working with some of the other utilities that are on the other side, on the Avenue of Champions side of the building, which include gas and electric and water. And then the storm utilities will be temporarily taken care of because we have a full site plan related to temporary stormwater control so that the site is controlled during construction. And then that final stormwater impact and control will happen towards the end of the project. So the entire site will be fenced off. We've got a full logistics plan that has been reviewed and approved by the university team, and we intend to have that site up and secured and fenced and installed as soon as possible here in May, and then we'll be working on, like I said, the abatement and demo. But the site plan itself, site logistics, fairly complicated. And will happen in those stages I just mentioned.
And Shane, to your other point around Hilltopper, that is not a responsibility of the partnership. The Student Life Foundation maintains the obligation to for demolition and clearing that site. That also will begin on the Monday after commencement, the 11th, and will be completed by the time students return to campus in August.
And the anticipated completion date of Regents and Normal, again, not under this agreement, but some date in 2027, and then those fee title comes to WKU as well.
We actually are making very good progress on those two facilities. There is a chance that we could get them sooner than 2027, but we don't want to set any expectations today on that.
Well, I have a question. I'm just curious, with everything going on, it's not tons going on right now, but how are the students through finals week and everything? How is the stress level? How are things working out with them?
That's a great question. This should all be invisible to them, I hope, other than their interest in what comes next. So we continue to maintain the facilities and have classes, and 2 weeks from yesterday, we'll walk down the hill. And I will say the snow week at the beginning of the semester did something strange to the spring this year. It because we had a weak start and then a week off, and then we started again, the semester feels shorter, certainly to me, but I think to everyone. Instead of being 16 weeks, it really felt like 14 weeks. There was a compression of material into that, I think, and so there's that stressor. But the 14 weeks has felt quicker, and so I think most students and many faculty that I've talked to feel like it's flown by faster than it even typically does. At least to me, it has.
Thank you.
No, I'd agree. So you can really start in a week.
So this fall, living arrangements will be about the same as they are right now. Nothing is going to change in the summer that's going to move people to different places.
That's right. What we're working through as we speak is the selection process, both for incoming and returning students. Returning students have made their selections. About two-thirds of the incoming class has made their preferences known, and the final group will begin that on Monday. We do have the addition this fall of campus flats outside of this agreement again. That's at least with the university as a housing option. Center Hall, the former Hyatt Place Hotel, continues as an option, also outside of the agreement. So we think we have navigated through the student demand and be able to take care of our students. It will be tight for this year, but if we were so fortunate to have an additional residence hall come online, example, one of Regents and or Normal, that could provide some additional flexibility and capacity, but we won't know that until a little bit later. But the goal is to have students make their selection, and the selection that they make be the room into which they move when they arrive.
I'm still just a little confused, I guess, on Regents and Normal, that once they're done, they come to us, that they go back into?
Correct. Ownership of them will pass to the university when the financing closes with Gilbane. SLF will be responsible to finish their renovations.
Right.
Then they will be transferred, the ownership will be transferred to CHF and added to their overall housing system. And again, the reason for the third party monitor is not just to protect the institution and ensure those repairs and restorations are done up to par, but also for Gilbane as well and Collegiate Housing, which will essentially assume the entirety of the system. Well, we'll have more time for questions. If we could move on to the next slide, I thought it would be helpful for everyone to see the way in which the funds flow through the project, and Mark Rollins will walk us through that next.
Thank you, President Cavone. And Mark Franklin hit on some of this already. This cash flow model operates very similarly to how the Student Life Foundation arrangement has worked for the last 20 plus years, with two fairly notable exceptions. The first, as Mark Franklin already mentioned, is that funds do return to the university as a form of ground rent. And sort of the magnitude of those we'll get to in a moment. But that up front is the key differentiator, right? In the past, the Student Life Foundation has retained all excess housing revenues to use to reinvest in the system as they saw fit. That decision now returns to the university along with the excess funds. The other primary difference is the fact that and I apologize for sort of getting into the weeds on this, but we have subordinated some of the expenses. And that means that to potential investors, that they are promised a payment of their debt payment before certain operating expenses are paid. And the operating expenses that we're referring to are housing and residence life expenses. And the reason that we did that was it was to strengthen the credit. If you're going to buy these bonds as an investment, then if you have a promise that you're going to be paid before some of the expenses are paid, then you have greater confidence that you're going to get a return on your investment, right? It becomes a more secure investment for you. And the rating agency, Standard & Poor's, who is an independent third-party agency that examines and scores the creditworthiness of the project, agreed. And they gave us an investment grade rating, which was not a slam dunk for these types of projects. And in fact, we've seen several larger institutions than WKU struggle to get over that finish line with similar projects. And the reason for that is that it's a relatively narrow revenue stream, right? If you think about the revenue stream of the housing system specifically within the context of the greater university revenue stream, it's much narrower, right? So while the university is rated in the A category, debt that's secured only by the housing revenue is going to be something lower than that. But by subordinating certain of these expenses, then we can get the bond investors to feel a lot more comfortable, the credit rating agencies to feel a lot more comfortable that that debt is going to be paid. And that's also true of the bond insurance companies, which I'll cover in a moment because I know that Regent Brody in particular may have some questions about that. But it got us lower premiums from the insurance companies as well because they view it as a stronger credit. And so that's the reasoning for that sort of arrangement. And I'll get to some more particulars on that sort of after we go through the general flow of funds. But the way that it'll work in practice is that the university will collect housing rents just as they always have. And instead of them going then to the Student Life Foundation, they're going to be deposited with the trustee bank for the transaction, which is Wilmington Trust. Wilmington Trust will first then pay the operating expenses that are not subordinated. So that's the things like keeping the lights on, you know, maintenance, and those sorts of things. Those will be paid first. And then from there, money will be deposited into the bond fund. And that is a fund that is set up specifically to collect payments to make sure that the debt obligations are paid. Attached to the bond fund are several ongoing bond-related expenses, including an annual trustee fee, a fee that is payable to the issuer, the Collegiate Housing Foundation, and then a couple of ancillary funds that I don't expect there to be regular deposits to, but they are in the indenture. Those include the Debt Service Reserve Fund, which really should only have deposits made into it if you've missed a bond payment, which is very bad indeed. And so we don't expect there to be regular or any payments into the Debt Service Reserve Fund. There's also the Rebate Fund. The IRS says that they don't want you earning more on certain of your funds attached to these sorts of bond issues. They don't want you earning more than you're paying. And if you do earn more than you're paying, then you have to rebate some of that to the federal government. So there's a fund exists where if you know you're earning more than you're supposed to, you can set funds aside in the rebate fund. Lastly, there's the Repair and Replacement Fund, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's a sort of a forced savings account where you're automatically setting funds aside for major repairs that would fall outside the sort of scope of regular maintenance and replacement of the buildings eventually. And so those sort of all represent the mandatory cash flow that has to happen before then the university starts getting funds back. And once those are met at the end of the fiscal year and the audit certifies that you've complied with your coverage covenant, which says, we promise to investors who buy these bonds that we are going to generate revenues sufficient to cover debt service by 1.2 times. And so once we have certified that, then anything in excess of the cash flows here is returned to the university. And those funds then go into several different buckets. There's a surplus fund. They go to pay those subordinated expenses that we talked about, which again is primarily what is currently HRL. And I know the president will speak to how that may change moving forward. An additional deposit to the repair and replacement fund that is right now supposed to be equal to $100 per bed. And the good news here, and I know that we talked about this in some of our meetings, there's a break-even point. At 70% occupancy, we cover debt service by one time. And that means that any occupancy level above 70% starts returning funds to the university. The occupancy level that is required to maintain the coverage covenant is about 80%. Both of those numbers are substantially lower than historical occupancy rates of the housing system at WKU, currently around 95%. 95% is also the number that is included in the base cash flows that we have. And so both of those numbers we feel like are very, very substantially below where we have been historically. And so therefore we feel comfortable then that the project will continue to generate surplus revenue that will come back to the university and go into those various buckets. To the point that in the very early years of the transaction or the operation of this model, a few million dollars. By the end, it grows to about $40 million of excess funds returned to the university. over the 40 years right now, we're looking at about $460 million in total. On a present value basis, it's about $125 million returned to the university through this model, which again is starkly different than what we've been doing for the last 25 years.
I'm sorry, yes, would you say the occupancy level at 80%? I know at 70% you said we would return me to the, what,
80%? 80% is the level required to hit that 1.2 times coverage level.
So God forbid we don't get like 70% or like 65%. So like, who doesn't get money? Like theoretically, the new HRL, like they don't get paid. Or how does that work?
Yes.
So then what?
Well, so in that case, I mean, those operations will continue, right? They would have to be paid out of university funds.
Okay, understood. But we also have bond insurance, right?
Right.
And so we walk through in that case what might happen.
Right, so bond insurance essentially serves as an additional layer of security for investors, right? So if the university, not the university, if the Collegiate Housing Foundation was going to miss a bond payment or a portion of a bond payment, then the bond insurance company would step in and say, here's your money. And what that does then, so the bonds themselves, as I discussed earlier, we were rated BBB minus. That's an investment grade rating. By virtue of having bond insurance, those bonds are now rated AA minus, which, yes, we have to pay a premium to the insurance companies, but we also get a substantially lower interest rate by virtue of having that bond insurance on the transaction, because investors now have this extra layer of security, right, promising them their payment. And the benefit of the insurance to the interest rate, I mean, it will be substantially lower, is easily more than enough to pay for the premium that you have to pay to the insurance company.
Thank you.
Mark, my question the other day to you was what the pricing would be, and I think you indicated that the pricing would be somewhere between the triple B minus or the lowest investment grade and the double A minus. It wouldn't be as good as AA minus,
right,
somewhere.
If this project were itself rated AA minus, you would probably get even further lower rates than what you get by virtue of having bond insurance on there. Because investors are not blind, right, to the reality of that. That there still is the fundamental model behind the bond insurance. And the bond insurance effectively buys you time to get things right if there was something bad, but it doesn't necessarily in and of itself permanently remedy a problem. So you're not going to get the full benefit, but you get a substantial portion of it.
And Rush, to your point, the other reason for creating this structure is that the debt is not university debt. It doesn't accrue to us, it accrues to the Collegiate Housing Foundation, which is a really important distinction here as well.
That's right. And in that manner of speaking, right, HRL or whatever it becomes, I mean, it is essentially an obligation of the university, right, to provide for the students. So, you know, that's another sort of theoretical reason why you would want to subordinate those types of expenses.
Yeah. Okay, well, if we could go to the next slide, I will turn it over to Julian, who will walk through kind of not just where we are, but what comes next. And as a part of that, because we are shifting the maintenance and operations responsibilities to Inwood from the Student Life Foundation, this provides us an opportunity both to create clarity around the care of our facilities in a way that we have not done before, including national PARs or KPIs and other arrangements that will ensure that the facilities are maintained as we would expect. And the other is it creates an opportunity for us to reimagine what housing residence life does and what it can become. Essentially, because their obligations for maintenance go away, they can shift their attention to things that are much more programmatic and academic and supporting of our students beyond just the housing portion of what they do, including certainly the living arrangements, but also student development and growth as well. So, Julian, I'll turn it over to you.
Berman, thank you, and it's great to be with you all today. I'll start and just take a step back and talk about the real scale of this project. So when we talk about Elevate WKU as a housing transformation, we mean it. We've talked a little bit about the scale of renovation, construction, demolition that will be happening over the next 2 years. In addition to that, as President Gavone mentioned, part of our immediate focus is on the transition of O&M from a mix of housing and the Student Life Foundation to in-work management. And I believe that within the management agreement, there are several features that allow for better protection for the university and for students, and will ultimately lead to a better experience for them across the project life cycle. As President Gavone mentioned, many of those are tied to KPIs, so Inwood's management fee is contingent upon meeting national cleanliness and performance standards within the entire portfolio of buildings, and then also biannual audits of those standards, as well as student satisfaction surveys with regard to facility maintenance. So if Inwood is not able to meet that standard, they are not paid. And we think that when we talk about this deal being a very long-term deal, that really provides the framework for long-term performance, ensuring that our partners are accountable to students. In addition to that, management is governed by a joint committee that is made up by representatives from the university, from Collegiate Housing Foundation, and from Inwood Management. They determine the capital program for spending in buildings. They determine the annual budgets, as well as administer those independent third-party audits and student surveys. So we think that there's a great structure for maintaining clarity, really, across the management program as we move forward. In addition, as President Boney had mentioned, doing this allows us to rethink really how housing residents like how the department is, you know, achieving its highest and best goals for the university and for the university's students. So because of the governance structure and with expertise, they are able to spend less of their time really reacting to maintenance issues and can think instead about how we really promote the key outcomes of that program, which include student recruitment, student retention, and ultimately student success. So our focus over the next summer is really going to be making a successful transition into this new management paradigm with Inwood. But in addition, we are taking a hard look at what are the different activities and capabilities that are required within housing residents' life to ensure those outcomes for students. And really, I think that's a very positive thing. I think that it should be looked at as a great opportunity for the institution and for the folks in housing residents' life, because we really get to think about, you know, what are the things that we need the most, and how do we, you know, elevate housing and the student experience across this entire deal. So it's a huge undertaking. I'll say as well, we are currently at the first inflection point in this process. We are, you know, moving into this new set of development projects and the O&M and facilities transition, but the university is not slowing down. In the fall, we will be thinking really very, very much immediately about the next phase of housing, which, as a reminder from our presentation back in February, would replace over 2,000 beds, nearly half the portfolio, by 2030, and virtually eliminate traditional style beds from the university's portfolio. So there's a lot of work to do, and in closing, I believe that the structure we've set up, not just within the P3 itself, but also internally within the university, enables a new kind of governance and proactive thinking that will help us get this done. And we look forward to returning in subsequent years to this group to report on our progress. And we think the future is bright. The deal that we have before us today really sets the tone going forward.
And I'll add to what Julian said, it has been a quick but not easy 14 months when we learned of some of the challenges that we would have to navigate. And I was reminded of what I said then, which was a big challenge requires a even larger, perhaps, solution. And the opportunity that we created is transformative for this institution. It will change our position in the marketplace. It will create an attractor instead of a hurdle that we have to overcome in the recruitment process. And while there is another phase to go. The vast majority of the work that you see in front of you is to set up a structure that will enable us to complete Elevate WKU phase one and two, but it also creates opportunities for additional phases down the road, a phase three or a phase four in the out years. And while we're not here to talk about that today, the structure is strong enough and enduring enough where it will enable other conversations to happen about future developments. And so for that, I'm also very, very proud. So questions for Julian around the phasing and what's to come? Well, I will end with this and ask Julian, who has had experience across other institutions and the national landscape. We knew this was going to be an all hands on the pump type of activity, and I want to publicly thank Andrea Anderson, who has led the effort, but also our entire leadership team, who has devoted countless hours. Susan Haworth, the Strategy Operations Finance Executive Vice President, the Provost Bud Fisher, Martha Sales, Kathleen Roche. I can't name everyone because it's such a large team that has met essentially multiple times per week on multiple committees along with our partners to get us to this place. And so I also will turn to our partners and say thank you for believing in the vision for where we could go as an institution and working with us to position us to achieve that. Julian, I will turn to you because you have, it's one thing for me to say how good this work has been, but you've seen other institutions go through these processes. We have accomplished this. Now, I did ask Julian if we could get the buildings up by fall of 27 last spring, and he and Brian laughed at me and said, well, no, that's not possible. So we went with 28. Julie, will you talk about the rapidity with which we have done this and the way we've done it as an institution compared to other places you've seen?
Of course. I mean, I'm glad that you thanked the committee members because I had my own list, but I was aware that I would not be able to cover everybody who has poured a lot of time and effort into this enormous undertaking. So as Ramona has mentioned, you know, a little over 14 months ago, we sat together and we said, what do we do about Regents, Normal, and Hilltop? How do we maintain the experience for students, our reputation as an institution, and really an opportunity to elevate all housing and move forward? From my perspective, it is an incredible feat to be where we are today, just 14 months later. The document package that is before you, 500 plus pages, the architectural documents, the work and hours that we put into this are truly enormous. And it is only possible with the buy-in of executive leadership on every level. And the folks with me around the table, the folks that I've spoken to, have been so impressed and so grateful to have President Kaboni's time, the time of the executive committee of university leadership, really getting into the details of every agreement, of every design document, and asking the question, what is best for the institution and what is best for students? You would think that having that is a lot of pressure, and certainly it is, but really, you know, when we ask that question, we're able to accelerate decision-making and, you know, bring this really elegant deal with a great deal of alignment before you all today. In many ways, the success that we have had is a dividend of that incredible time and effort that every administrator has put in to this over the past year. As I said before, I also think this is a hopeful sign. It really sets the tone for what we'll be able to accomplish over the next 5 years and beyond. You know, it's really great that when we have, you know, design discussions, when we have discussions around conflict resolution around these agreements, we are able to think at the highest possible level. And that's why we've been able to move this forward so effectively.
Thank you, Julian. I appreciate that. And as I turn around, I realize I did leave. John Mark Francis has been in those meetings. Corinne Murphy's been in those meetings. Brian Russell's been. Everybody's been in all of the meetings all the time. And one of the interesting things about having the president in the room when you're making choices around very, very technical things like
the color and pattern on carpet or other things, is that you don't have to, the decision isn't made in the room and then it gets brought to leadership. Leadership is standing there working alongside everyone else, and it allows for quick resolutions of challenges and essentially a common front for the entirety of the project. I have been through this process before, and I was on a leadership committee or steering committee, and it was frustrating to me then, and would have been had we done it that way here, when decisions were made and then brought to the leadership team, and leadership says, no, I don't like that, go back and do it again. So it then goes back to the other team, and then it comes back. We don't have any of that here. We're all sitting around the table, and I do have veto power on some things, and I very rarely exercise that, but it just makes things much more seamless, keeps everyone on the same page and honest, and I'm proud that we're not working in silos. We're working in cross-functional ways with everyone's voice being heard and everyone rowing the same direction on campus and with our off-campus partners as well. And with that, that's the end of the presentation.
I would like to make one comment going back to expressing gratitude to the Student Life Foundation, since I've been close to that with my spouse and knowing what a difficult, rocky time they've had. I want to express appreciation, I know, to Catherine LaRoche, who came in and took over at a precarious time and has done an exceptional job. And I know another steady hand at the wheel for them has been Mark Rawlings. I've heard their names mentioned numerous times, so point them out individually.
You're here.
I would say that this makes a lot of sense in terms of strategic alignment. As you and I have talked, as I've been on the board, you know, we differentiate ourselves of having an on-campus experience, which I know you believe in, that makes us different in the marketplace than those who are marketing themselves to someone who might be sitting in their mother's basement and drinking Code Red and eating Hot Pockets and taking an online class. Mm-hmm. We want to have students here. We want them to have that the opportunity to go to the football stadium, the basketball arena, the band, and be in the classrooms and where the faculty know their names and learn and get the housing, for whatever reason, has had its drift to where it's become a hurdle to students wanting to have that on-campus experience. And so strategically, it makes sense with what we're trying to build. I think Regent Brody and I have spent a long amount of time on the financial side of it as well. So I think we feel pretty good about that.
We do.
Mark, I have one further question regarding backstopping eventually the university, but backstopping the developer. We're worried about, are they going to finish on time? Are there going to be problems financially? Could you address the guarantee of the Elkhill Bay Development Company?
It's okay. I'll let Steve Park, he's been deep into those issues, let him address that for us.
Thank you. Happy to do that. Yes. So under the development agreement between CHF and the developer, is the developer is a single purpose LLC. So Elkhill Bay Development Company will provide a guarantee, and under the guarantee, they basically guarantee all of the payment obligations of the developer and the performance obligations. So it's a full wrapped deal, I suppose is the best way to put it. There are also payment performance bonds that have to be put up for the full amount of the work by the contractors in this case, because they're the ones that are doing the work. So it's pretty secure in terms of the overall performance of Gilbane. And I'll let Jeffrey Thurston explain more if there's any more questions.
Yeah, one other thing that is contained in that agreement beyond the performance of our work on time and on budget is a penalty if we are late. There are liquidated damages. There is financial obligations that we have to make that can become significant if students are displaced. That involves room, transportation, daily per diem, moving costs. So outside of the other things that are related to a penalty to not delivering things on time and on budget, there is that ultimate liquidated damage clause that is kind of hanging over, and that flows all the way from the developer all the way down to the general contractor. So that is a major motivation beyond everything else to make sure that we deliver on time and on budget.
You have read my mind and answered my question before I asked it.
Any other questions? Well, I just have a comment, and I am very impressed with all the work that went into this. Very proud to be on the board during this time period. And as a lawyer, I was very impressed with the legal documents. I read them all, and everything's very thorough, and I felt very happy and satisfied with that work as well. So that being said, if no one has any other questions, I'll call for a motion to approve the authorization of the P3 housing project.
So moved. Second.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Okay, motion passes. Thank you all very much.
Well, this is a huge milestone. It is not the final milestone. We can't exhale yet. We have one final procedure to endure. That will be on Monday at the Capital Projects and Bond Oversight Committee in Frankfurt, where I and a cast of others will present the project for legislative approval. And after that, we will move toward final close date of the May 28th, and we'll continue our work between here and there. But this is an important milestone for our leadership, but more importantly for our institution. This creates, as Shane was mentioning, a transformative experience for our undergraduate students. It allows us to essentially increase the number of living learning communities to over half of our incoming class. It creates a differentiator for us in the marketplace and will be a spectacular set of facilities that our community will enjoy for generations. And so I would not have wished last February through May on anyone. I think that what we've done with the intervening time has been remarkable. And it's something, as Janie said, we should all be very proud of and positions us well for the decades to come.
All right. Thank you very much. And we are adjourned.